This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything, to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. We turn to the large story of recovery in the time of the war in Europe, in the time of the lockdowns in China, in the time of inflation, and this from the governor of the Bank of England, that is like the chairman of the Federal Reserve. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, is facing a backlash from ministers over his claim that Britain faces apocalyptic rises in food prices and warning that his language is irresponsible. Andrew Bailey told MPs within these last hours that he felt helpless because rises in inflation were being driven by a series of external shocks, including Russia's invasion of Ukraine and supply chain problems caused by lockdowns. He said that Ukraine, one of the world's major producers of wheat and cooking oil, was struggling to export food while the conflict continued. The governor went on to use the word famine. Joe, we're looking at what the governor is saying has been in front of us for some weeks, and yet there seems to be a debate about it. There are food shortages right now in the Horn of Africa. There are questions about petrol prices being afforded by the truck drivers to deliver the goods if they're at the quayside to the stores that need them. There certainly is an enormous amount of wheat that is not being exported from the Black Sea. So to identify the problem here, the Bank of England says there's an apocalyptic moment. Does that language suit the politics of England right now, the politics of Europe? Are other European nations echoing this assertion by Andrew Bailey?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a discussion already about whether his use of the word apocalyptic was a bit strong. But I mean, this is definitely a serious situation that you're seeing unfolding across a bunch of dimensions, and not just in any one Western economy, not just in developed economies in general, but around the world. And I think that you have an immediate food shortage problem that is in danger of developing because Ukraine is such an important part of the agricultural supply chain. But remember, I mean, Andrew Bailey is a UK policymaker, and his primary responsibility has to do with the British economy. And frankly, here the cost of living crisis for a lot of households can feel pretty apocalyptic because you have skyrocketing energy prices. Food price inflation is going through the roof. I was watching an analysis in the television news here earlier today about how the cost of clothing has skyrocketed far ahead of the rate of wage growth over the past 5 years. So I think people are definitely feeling the pain, and they are looking for someone to do something about it. And I bristle a little bit when I hear policymakers like Andrew Bailey, you know, talking about these global phenomena that are outside of their control. Some of it is outside of his control, but it's also the fact that Western policymakers, whether it's Bailey or whether it's Jerome Powell at the Federal Reserve or Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank, have not done everything they could or should have done to do their part to control some of these inflation dynamics that are now wreaking such havoc in their own countries and around the world. And so I think that we can recognize that there is an element of truth to what Bailey was saying without necessarily letting him get away with what can be interpreted in some sense as an attempt to pass the buck, or here you'd be passing the pound.
Our cost of living is what in the United Kingdom we call inflation here in the U.S. And no one needs to argue that the inflation isn't a threat. Perhaps it doesn't rise to the language of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, but it is a grinding problem going forward for the least among us. I mentioned Africa. There are other questions being raised about fertilizer, for example, being being available for South America, for the crops of Brazil. So I turned back to the inflation. I pulled back from the cliffside and look at the inflation picture. The Federal Reserve has moved. The Bank of England moved even before the Federal Reserve. And you have written very carefully about inflation for more than a year and a half, when it was called transitory, when it was called supply shock. Is there evidence now that the combined strength of the central bankers is moving the story away from the spiking inflation?
Not yet, because the problem is that they are all very far behind the curve, because as you pointed out, we could see that this inflation was brewing a year and a half ago almost now. Only now are they really starting to act. And I mean, the key thing about inflation is that historical experience has shown that to combat it, to bring it down, you have to reach a point where your interest rates are above the rate of inflation. You actually need a positive inflation-adjusted interest rate in order to bring it under control. And both the UK and the US, and especially the Eurozone, where nominal interest rates are still negative, are so far away from that condition of the nominal interest rate being higher than the rate of inflation, the level of interest rate increase that we're going to have to see in order to reach that point suggests that they would need to be tightening for the next couple of years before they can get there. So unless they are prepared to start moving a lot faster than they have been, I think that unfortunately they are going to be perpetually behind the curve.
And Joe, the supply chain problem does exist. And there is also the consideration that year over year is going to look better just because of where we are in the recovery cycle. Is there, at this time, information that we need to know whether it's ebbing or not? Is it too early to know if the ebbing is not going to be organic with the history of where we are?
Well, I mean, most signs actually point to it continuing to be pretty bad, if not getting a little bit worse, because, I mean, if you look at the leading indicators that tend to feed into the consumer price inflation rate at the end, I mean, things like the producer prices, which is the price of things as they leave the factory, before they get to the store shelf, those sorts of prices have been increasing pretty rapidly of late. And, you know, that will eventually show up in the form of higher consumer price inflation. I think that there's a real question about whether the government accurately measures housing costs, which suggests that there might be a lot of inflation that is not being reflected in the official data, which is happening out in the real economy when people do their household budgets right now. And so I think that we're still in for a bumpy ride. And then on top of that, you are going to have continuing supply chain problems from China, which is caught in this zero COVID limbo with all of the lockdowns, which keep weighing on global supply chains, which is only going to add to the pressure. And I think that consumers are in for a really tough ride for the foreseeable future.
All inflation is not prices. There's also inflated language. And I turn to Boris Gate and Beers for Kiergate. To summarize is impossible, other than to say that Boris Johnson got in trouble because of his conduct during the lockdowns, during the first year of the pandemic. Then Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, got in trouble because, I think it's this straightforward, with a number of his friends and colleagues, he was on a tour of the constituencies. They sent out for, I believe it was ethnic food, I think it was Indian food, curry, and he drank a beer. And now Boris is dancing away, smiling, and Keir is in trouble, Joe? Is that right? Keir's inflated language of the gravity of Boris's offense has now come back at him?
Yes, I mean, this is one of history's great ironies, because problem, what both of them are in trouble about in various forms is the suggestion that they did not follow the very strict pandemic lockdown rules that were in place at various times over the past couple of years. On balance, the evidence appears to be that Boris Johnson did not follow those rules to a greater extent than Keir Starmer didn't follow them. I mean, Boris Johnson has received several fines from the police. There are suggestions that there may be more on the way at some point. His staff seemed to have been involved in more parties than Starmer's was. The problem is that Keir Starmer made a tactical error as the leader of the opposition when he came very strong out of the gate when the scandal broke over the winter by suggesting, well, Boris must resign, Boris must resign, Boris must resign over this. The problem is, having said that, now that the allegations come out that Keir Starmer might have been involved in a party, and we're still waiting for the investigation on that to wrap up, but if it turns out that he did engage in an illegal gathering of some sort, well, Starmer said that that is a resignable offense. And the problem he's got is that Boris never said anyone should resign about this. So they both could be accused of hypocrisy for breaking the lockdowns, if that's what Starmer did. But only Starmer could then be accused of hypocrisy for not resigning. So I think that managed to be a bad bit of political tactical thinking there that might backfire spectacularly if he's not careful.
This was a very hot story for the latter part of the winter and the early part of the spring. Has it left the front of news in the television news? Has it moved away from the debates on Radio 4 about whether Boris Johnson should or should not stay? Has it quieted down, Joe?
I mean, in the public eye, it is in abeyance right now, mainly because there hasn't been any news on it recently. We're still waiting for the police investigation of Boris Johnson and his staff at number 10 Downing Street to conclude. And we are also still waiting for the civil service report from this bureaucrat, Sue Gray, who has been working on a detailed report about the party culture at number 10. We're waiting for that. And meanwhile, we're also waiting for whatever conclusions we're going to get about what Keir Starmer and his Labour Party colleagues got up to at various points during the lockdown. But I wouldn't say that it is going away yet, because my argument all along has been that both of these politicians, but especially Boris, are vulnerable for other reasons. With Boris, he's vulnerable over his mishandling of the economy and the current inflation and cost of living crisis. And the problem with the party scandal from that perspective is that it is going to keep going. So right now, we're not paying any attention to it because the Conservatives are not trying to get rid of Johnson. If they decide at some point in the future that they do want a new leader, the parties will be right there waiting for some enterprising, you know, clack of conservative MPs to swoop in and seize on the party allegations as a reason to get rid of him.
I'm speaking to Joseph Sternberg about a scandal that's been with us in Parliament for some months. Joe's in London, reading the London media, and we're about to turn to another scandal that's fresh to both of us. It doesn't involve the fate of nations. It certainly doesn't involve crime. Well, at least crime that rises the level of violence. It does, however, involve very famous football players and their wives. The wives and girlfriends of the famous players in London are called WAGs. And when we come back, Wagatha Christie, the scandal. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.